Yeah, good evening, Roy. I just wanted to make an inquiry.
Sure.
This is unrelated to the conversation at the moment. Due to the wind, the high wind that we had, unfortunately, my G5 antenna came off at the pole and came off of the pulley. And I was wondering if anybody knows of anybody that could help me put it up, put it back up. I'll pay them, of course, because it's difficult for me to do it because I had a bypass. And definitely could use someone to help me. I wonder if there's anybody that you know or on the net that puts the antennas up. It's handy and does it as a sideline. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Howard. I'm sorry to hear you having problems. I had a great deal of problems with having people come and help me with my antenna. I mean, thankfully, I found a few people who were very kind and came by and helped me out. I tended to use the services of a ham, Leo. I'm sure you know of Leo. He was a friend of Harold Goretzky. He's moved to Detroit, so, you know, he's very seldom in this area. This guy, Jeff, I unfortunately don't recall his call sign, but he's the guy who kind of runs the AM Dinosaur Net. I think he found someone local to help him fix up some things with his antenna, so you might try contacting him. I heard he had some health issues recently, but, you know, he may have a name for you. Right now, the guy that I use, that I pay, kind of comes into New York once or twice a year when I'm lucky.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Roy. Yeah, I know Leo. He's out there in the West. That's a lead. I appreciate that. And if anybody else knows of anybody, I'd certainly appreciate a contact. I'm at w2hl@yahoo.com. And thanks very much, Roy. We'll be, I guess, step out of the car, but thanks for letting me state this. Back to you, Roy.
You could put an ad in for a handyman.
Okay, didn't get the link yet, but when I get it, I'll try and read it. It's kind of difficult to do. I just got it. I wish you luck, Howard. Again, if anyone out there knows anyone who's interested in doing this kind of work, unfortunately, that has been my biggest pet peeve about this hobby, that it's very, very difficult to get assistance with it. And I'm very thankful for the people that gave me help in my time of need. But if anyone has any ideas and like to pass it on to Howard, is w2hl@yahoo.com. And hopefully Howard heard Rich comment about a handyman. I kind of tried all kinds of things. I looked in Yellow Pages. I used email. I can't tell you how many different ways people said, I don't know what you're talking about. Unfortunately, I even tried antenna installation retailers. For the most part, they set up satellite dishes, and they don't know how to do anything but satellite dishes. So I wish you luck, Howard. Wesley, I think you wanted to say something?
Yeah. If you look at, just open up the link, there is not much to read there, but the concept is interesting. And Amadek is not for hands. I think it's professional corporation making stuff based on respect to military mostly, not only. So if you look at MFC Terry, which is the first picture on the top, but it is also listed as a third down the road. That's 50 ohm impedance, input impedance, from the terminals. What is interesting is two loops changing the position. That's what I was talking about, the area. Enter exit.
One uniform.
Yeah, John recognized. I just want to point out that I've been going through this. Apparently, this has almost nothing to do with what we were talking about. It's apparently because they seem to kind of bond it to other information, and it seems to be designed to detect 50 to 60 hertz magnetic field testing. So I think we're really in the deep grass, Wesley, with this particular antenna that you found us. But getting back to John, you wanted to say something, John. I was going to say, before I get back to you, just for a second, I have tried in the past using my refrigerator as the ground for a magnetic antenna, and it was semi-decent because it's near windows in the kitchen, so that's another option, perhaps.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to comment on to the fellow who was, I didn't write his call, who was interested in help. I used to live in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Worcester Polytech had a radio club, and that was a source of young, healthy, interested kids, generally who would be happy to work with you. So my suggestion was check around for schools, particularly colleges, not high school, that might have radio clubs and see if you can find some people there who would like to help put up an antenna.
Okay, that's good advice. I didn't go to college clubs because I couldn't really find that many college clubs. Locally, as far as I'm aware, you know, there's some high schools like Brooklyn Tech who are one of our club members. Mentors. Columbia has a very active club that does a lot of testing. I don't know exactly if they do other things like helping people. I joined two local clubs with the idea of asking people to help me with an antenna. And I even contacted this guy that I had not heard of before who ran this thing called the Limark Technical Net, Dick K2RIW. And he's had some interesting suggestions that I just kind of call out and tell people that we'll have an antenna-raising party, except unfortunately, since I didn't have an antenna, I couldn't transmit to tell people that I needed help transmitting, getting an antenna. So, yeah, that's another idea, I guess. I don't know if there's that many college amateur radio clubs around, though.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
I put both my dual band antenna and my fan dipole up in one day. I had the super of the building came and helped me do it. He had knowledge of antennas. I think he worked in marine band radio.
Okay, I mean, if you try hard enough, you might find someone to assist you. But if you can't visually do it, it's kind of difficult. I mean, I found a way around it the first time before I was able to really get out and ask anyone to help on the radio. Ultimately, what I did was I set up the entire antenna system in my backyard, which was a terrible place for it, but that was right before I had my roofers re-roof my house, and part of the deal was that they would just kind of raise it up and screw it down and leave it there. So that's how the first time I got my antennas up is with roofers, and I kind of designed all the ropes and pulleys and what have you so that it would be, just you could raise it and just lock it in. So there are ways, but I understand Howard's problem. He just needs kind of a utility guy that can just climb up a tree or something and tighten something up and make sure the ropes are good. And, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, the simpler problems are more difficult.
Bravo Zulu?
Yes, Rich.
You know, maybe a call to a roofing company, you know, just saying that, you know, I'm looking for a person to, you know, help me put up a structure on my roof. Would you have somebody, do you think, that, you know, on the weekends or, you know, during their free time, they want to earn some extra money? And I would think, you know, if it's a small mom-and-pop type company, roofing-type company, you know, that put up gutters or, you know, shingles on roofs, redo roofs, I think they would pass along your information, and you'd probably get a couple of calls like that.
Okay, you might be right. Unfortunately, after the roofers kind of put the thing up, they didn't really understand the idea that the transmission line isn't supposed to hang along with the antenna wires, and so things got kind of tangled. And I tried that with these people, both as a company or their employees. They didn't work out for me. I had a few promises, but no one ever showed up, and I kind of gave up on that. So I guess if you find a mom-and-pop roofing company and or they have guys who aren't really busy putting up roofs, you might find something. Chris, K2STP, on the chat room mentioned that he used a local tree service guy to get up with one of those bucket trucks. So that also might be a possibility.
Contact?
Yes, contact.
Hi, this is Chet, WB2AHK. I'd like to ask W2HL a question. I might be able to come up with a solution. I do antenna installations. Is he there? Howard, are you there? Over.
Yes, I am. I just got into the car. Go ahead there, Chet.
All right. My question is, what exactly happened? I know in the high winds, and you have a pulley, and the wire is jumping around. They can hop out of a pulley. Could you tell me exactly what happened? I might have some ideas for you. Go ahead.
Well, the pole is connected to the chimney with chimney brackets. The pole is interconnected with these army. It's an army type of mast. They're interconnected 5-foot poles, and have some guy wires up there. So anyway, basically what happened is that the center, the pulley holds up the at the rope, at the end of the rope where the pulley is, and it's holding up the center part of the antenna, you know, where the lateral line and meets the two ends of the antenna. So that was held up by the rope that towards the top. That came, the whole center insulator came off of the rope. And the rope now is up at the top, the end of it is up at the top, and there's no way that I could, you know, I could get to the antenna, but I can't pull the rope, because the rope is all the way pulled, and the end of it is up at the top of the, on the other side of the pulley. So the only way that the rope can be reached to pull up the antenna is to take off the or to lower the mast. So I'm going to need help with that aspect of it. Over.
right, okay, the B2AHK, how high is the chimney? And he said a 5-foot military mask. How high up is this arrangement where the rope fell off the pulley? Go ahead.
Well, the pit in the mast is about, I'd say about 25, 30 feet. And the chimney is about 5 feet off the roof.
Are you saying that the pipe is 25 feet above your roof, or does your pipe extend down to the ground?
No, the pipe is, the mast is alongside the chimney, so the first 5 feet of it is secured with brackets, and the rest of it, say 20 feet, is free, clears the chimney, and it's secured with guy wires.
So the question again, how high is the pipe altogether above the roof? Are you saying it's like 25 feet above the roof?
I'd say 20, 25 feet, yes.
So, if someone had a ladder and could put it up against the chimney, I don't know how high your chimney is, and loosens up the bolts on the bracket that's holding the pipe, would that pipe slide downward towards, downward towards the ground? Or would the top of the pipe arrive, if you loosened up the bracket, would the top of the pipe arrive a few feet above the top of the chimney?
Well, I think that some parts of the mast are together. In other words, I think we put a pole within the chimney to maintain the strength. So there are some sections of the mast that can be loosened. But the bracket holding the mast, you know, that could be those could be loosened, and the pole will come away from the chimney.
Okay, one more question: how high is the chimney off the ground?
Well, I'm able to access the chimney from the terrace on the second floor. So there's a terrace on the second floor, and I just put a step ladder, and I'm right on the roof right next to the chimney.
All right. Okay, I already sent you an email. I do things like that. I have a lot of experience and skills in that area, and I think I could take care of that problem for you. So I sent you an email, and look for my email, and we'll converse. And if you could take a picture and send me a picture of it from the ground level, I would know more about it. But I got a pretty good idea. I know exactly what you need done, and the fact that you can access the chimney from your terrace, that makes it much easier. Go ahead.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I really appreciate that, Chet. I'm going to look at your email, and I'll send you the pictures, and I'll try to hook up with you on the phone maybe tomorrow. How is that?
That's good. And I also have that military mast thing. I have, the military mast thing that you're talking about is 3-foot sections. Is that the military mast thing? Go ahead.
I think they have 4-foot sections, 4 or 5-foot sections.
All right. I think, you're right. I have a box of them. They come in fiberglass, which don't hold up. They're tent poles, actually. And I have the aluminum version. I have a whole box of them. So will I have supplies? Okay, well, contact me tomorrow anytime between 10 and 1, if you can. I'll make sure, I'll send you an email again, make sure I have my phone number in it. I forgot if I sent my phone number. And that's something I could do. There's no problem. You can take care of that. All right. Thank you very much, Ned. Go back to right now to net control. WB2AHK.
Yeah, thank you very much. Tremendous thanks, Chet. Back to you there, Rory.
Just a Rory question.
Yes, AC2GS for anyone interested. Yes, Wesley, what question is that?
Yeah, you were right about that link, but my question is it true that many ham radio operators you need a good way to locate radio frequency interference in HF band with the small direction finding antenna and portable radio? At HF, but they could also look at 6 meters and 2 meters for the interference inside of their house and outside. Would you think that me preparing the material for it would be interested to hams and to exchange?
Well, yeah. I mean, Andy does a lot of fox hunting, which is similar. And I've talked to a few guys who are out there with jerry-rigged antennas and receivers trying to find local causes for interference. But, you know, an outline of the best method of finding local interference would probably be a nice thing.
Yeah, when you told me that this antenna was for 60 and 50 hertz, I was trying to Google up, and I found some interesting antennas, loop antennas, that could be plugged into the ham radio or portable radio. And they could easily spot 3 to 22 megahertz in some instances, in some other instances, the RFI at lower frequencies, starting from 1 kilohertz to 10 megahertz. And there is also the way to find a specific frequency interference, and it's just easy. It's a loop, a magnetic loop antenna. And to exchange.
Well, yeah, loop antennas have very often been used for direction finding. A little bit more esoteric, complicated would be Doppler arrays of verticals where they're hooked together, and by calculating the timing differences between the reception of the different antennas, they are able to give a good indication of the directionality. So, yeah. But loop antennas certainly are quick and easier to make and to use.
I assume this subject is one of your favorites, right?
What subject would that be?
Loop antennas.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's one of my favorites. Magnetic loops. There's a big difference between a loop antenna in general and a magnetic loop. They have different radiation patterns, requirements, mechanical problems. They're practically two different types of antennas. But magnetic loops certainly is a popular topic for discussion. I think one of the major things is because they're relatively small and don't have location requirements that most other antennas need a certain amount of height and clearance and other such things. But the downside, as we've often mentioned with magnetic loops, is because of the inordinately high Q rating of the resonance of the antenna, you have to retune those antennas every time you change frequency. unless you have some kind of automated servo mechanism that costs money, that could be a pain in the backside.
Yeah, it could be partially air-shocked, right? But it could be partially solved if you have a simple resonant loop with a smaller coupling loop antenna only for receiving if there is a concern about very high efficiency and high voltages. So component section is then simplified. That's one of the things. The other thing is that starting from 1932, those antennas were used by military also. And some interesting concept is that a piece of wire, the loop of wire, was in completely sealed piece of metal tubing, and that was used also for prolongation. Prolongation, is this the proper word? The German way of triangulation. Prolongation, is that the right word and direction?
The only word I know that fits is triangulation. I'm not quite sure if that's the word you're saying, where you, by having three points and three directions, you are able to calculate where they intersect, and that's you're triangulating a source of transmission.
Yeah, in 1999, I was asked to be in front of 200 people, personnel, mostly military scientists and engineers in Columbus, Georgia. And they were interested at that time with some aspects in regards to Kosovo and the conflict there. And then I rise with the concept of virtual points, which was actually creating a point that don't exist, but be precisely set in space. That was another concept of multi-point triangulation for sniper guns. But the project didn't launch because the conflict of Kosovo ended up and SBR didn't have that subject on the table then. That's my 5 cents. And to actually.
Okay. Let me kind of go all the way back, and someone's going to give me tourists for kicking a dead horse type of thing. I just want to make sure, John, NQ1U, that we kind of toss the subject around as much as possible, and I wish you good luck, and if you come up with something, please come back and tell us how it worked out.
No, you'll get appreciation from me, not sir. Thank you for all the input and the help. One final thing is, I'm thinking of actually a dipole because I have a long window, and I wonder what your thoughts are on cross polarization. Do I really lose that much in attenuation because if I go horizontal? I know it's not the way to go with 2 meters, but what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, theoretically, if we lived not in the real world but in the theoretical world, because basically the interaction is basically the cosine function. So the cosine of 90 degrees is zero. So in a theoretical world, you would have an infinite amount of attenuation. In the real world, you do get about 15 to 20 decibels, I think, most of the time. And that to me is that's a big price to pay. So if you could all possibly orient it in a vertical way, I think you would see a significant improvement.
Oh, that's a great answer. Thanks a lot. I appreciate everybody's time on this. thanks a lot for your help. This is NQ1U. I'll be back in a week.
Contact again.
Yes.
In reference to the gentleman, I think he was just on, asking about an antenna in Manhattan for 2 meters and 440, and he had no place to put it outside. I was thinking of roof flashing as a radiator. Take some roofing copper flashing. They come in various sizes. You can get little pieces. I have them. I can give it to the guy if he's interested. I can mail it to him. An inch and a half, 3 inches wide. And make a dipole, vertical dipole. And use tape it to the window. Tape a feed line to the center. One for 2 meters, one for 440. And it'll be broadbanded. And separate the two different antennas so they won't be close to each other for coupling. And you'll have a 2 meter and a 440 antenna, and the roof flashing is very thick and wide, and it'll be broadbanded.
Question 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich, recognize that's a good idea. I don't know. I would probably first try something more obscure and where people, if they looked at basically, I would try something like copper-clad steel wire. It would just kind of be hidden against the building, whereas I would assume flashing is going to flash a bit. But, it certainly will give you a slightly lower Q and a broader resonance. Rich, what did you want to say?
Yeah, whatever type of antenna that you choose, it has to be vertically oriented. I had the opportunity to hold a beam, a Yagi, in my hand and rotate it horizontally and vertically. And I'm 22 miles from Selden. And when I held the Yagi horizontally, I couldn't hear Selden at all. And when I rotated it, so it became a vertical Yagi, Selden came booming in. So that's crucial that the orientation be vertical.
Yeah, I would agree with you. The best for this type of a situation, repeaters all have vertically polarized antennas. So if you want to get the best distance, the best range, the closer it is to vertical, the better. You could, I guess, make a case that, there are some people who are operating FM in vertical mode, and they also like to operate single sideband. Those antennas usually are oriented in the horizontal polarization direction. So I guess the cutest trick for something like that would be to get a circularly polarized antenna. So you'd only have the most 3 decibel loss between a vertical or a horizontal would give you the same 3 decibel loss, and you wouldn't have the incredible 15, 20, 25 decibel loss that if you try and use a horizontal antenna to receive a vertical antenna's transmission. Yes.
I've been listening to the conversation I have a friend who has successfully contacted around the world using an antenna inside his house. If I could get back to my seat and get that gentleman's email, I would be happy to connect him.
Okay, very good, Kathleen. He's John NQ1U. I'm sure he's on QRZ. John, would you like to give your email or where your email can be found?
Is there a way to do this a little more discreetly than on radio? I don't know. I've never done that.
Well, are you listed on QRZ?
I mean, it's a licensed station. Isn't that what every QRZ has?
No, if you don't give them your email address, they don't publish the email address. They'll publish your mailing address, but not necessarily your email address.
Okay, well, let me throw out one. Hold on a second. It's Juliet Bravo Sierra Charlie Alpha Romeo 202 at yahoo.com.
Okay, did you get that, Kathleen? By the way, I checked your QRZ page, John, and you don't have an email listed there. It's always nice to do that. I list my email on QRZ. You know, only amateurs can look at that information, so I don't know. I don't mind getting email.
Yeah, I'll do that. Thank you.
So, Kathleen, did you get John's email address? Well, nothing much heard. Let me just check to see if Catherine has her email address on QRZ. No, she doesn't have an email address either. It's very. I must have told this story way too many times, so what the heck, I'll tell it again. When I first got licensed 11 years ago, I had that problem about antennas and such. And so I sent a lot of people a lot of emails, and I found this curious, weird thing. No one answered me. So I thought that my email server was broken. I would send myself emails. And I finally realized that at least 11 years ago, amateur radio operators often did not like emails. And so they did not respond to emails for the most part. And those early days, the only guys who ever responded to my emails were either vendors or ARRL officials. Otherwise, a significant portion never responded to my emails. So that's my little email story. I think email is our friend. I think we all should provide it on our QRZ page. We might get a couple of nonsensical emails from people, but you probably get a lot of nonsensical emails. So keep that in mind, people out there. If you haven't looked at QRZ in a while, it's a free service. You can post your email. You could write a little dissertation of your shack that you're proud of. People can look at my QRZ page. I have pictures of my little shack and my computer set up for one night when I was doing the science talk on the TechNet, so take a look. Anyway, I think we kind of did what we could do. We kind of discussed with John the idea of an internal antenna system. It sort of depends upon what kind of a building you have and if there's open space beyond your walls and your walls aren't chicken wired into a Faraday cage. But I wish you luck, John, and I'm glad that everyone kind of came up with different ideas and suggestions, and I hope you find something to your liking.
Yeah, that was a great exchange. I appreciate you being the quarterback, and thanks to everybody for coming in, and I hope Kathy's got that. That's great. Okay, this is NQ1U. I'll be standing by.
Okay, well, rather than ask for any other questions, so there'll still hopefully be time for questions, I thought maybe we'll take one of the puzzle questions because we kind of touched upon it earlier tonight. My little question, and preferably I would prefer if non-electrical engineers try to answer this because I assume all the electrical engineers kind of know this in their sleep. But if you had to describe a measurable quality of an antenna that pretty much was the same as saying it's a resonant antenna, what would that value be? Now, keep in mind a couple of things. Dick, may rest in peace. K2RIW used to regularly say, first you resonate and then you radiate. So it's very important to know what exactly resonating means. Also, as a little bit of a hint, different resonant antennas have different impedances. A half-wave dipole in free space has an impedance of 73 ohms. A quarter-wave ground plane in space has a nominal impedance of 37.5 ohms. So with all those little bits and pieces in mind, does anyone want to hazard a guess of what kind of a measurable value that you can do with an antenna will indicate that your antenna is resonant?
Impedance, I suppose, WB2BXL.
Yeah, Wesley recognized, but, you know, Frank's on the echo link, so let's give Frank a chance.
Got through the first time. That's a rarity for me on especially on HF. But anyway, I suggested impedance. You well want to have impedance equal to the impedance of your feed line. Go ahead.
Okay, well, that will give you the best energy transfer. Andy WA2CDL did a little talk on the most efficient energy transfer is when you match the impedances, and plus you won't have the reflection losses and such. But all things being equal, as I said before, A half-wave dipole in free space is resonant when you measure it at 73 ohms. So it's not like I guess the point might be that you would use a 75 ohm transmission line in free space if you needed a transmission line in free space. But still, there's some kind of aspect that I don't think enough people talk about when they're discussing resonance. They just kind of say, yeah, it's resonant. It's a standing wave antenna. It bounces back and forth, so it's resonant. That they don't get into the very, very crystal clear thing about resonance that is very obvious regarding, I'll give you another hint, regarding its impedance. Not that it's matched to the transmission line you're choosing, but there's another quality of impedance for a resonant antenna that isn't the case for a non-resonant antenna.
It has to do with the end waves or the energy at the end of the antenna?
Well, you know, I mean, we could wax poetic about what standing waves do, but I want to keep it in a very, very narrow guideline. You can take a test, a piece of calibrated equipment, make a measurement, and say, according to my measurement, your antenna is resonant. So that takes away from, discussions of analogies of what's going on with the wave phenomena. Now, someone in the chat room is answering the question. I just wonder if someone not in the chat room can answer the question as well.
Yeah, you're talking about quality analysis of antenna reflection coefficient. So the answer is WR.
No. But thanks for trying. I kind of narrowed it. It's a quality of impedance that's unique for a resonant antenna.
ACTPL, what's the question?
How can you tell that your antenna is ultimately resonant, given a measurable quantity, which I've already mentioned has to do with an impedance?
The capacitance equals the inductance.
Okay, but can you kind of solve the equation and make it even simpler that way?
All that's left is the resistance if the capacitance cancels out the inductance. It's pretty simple.
Okay, but you'd be surprised how many people don't really know that, because most people don't discuss it. When antennas are resonant, there is pure resistance. There is no inductive reactance. There is no capacitive reactance. The complex impedance of a resonant antenna should be a real resistance. But also what I personally find interesting is it's a special kind of resistance. If you want to suggest what kind of resistance is left behind.
Yeah, radiation resistance. I love this topic, by the way. AC2PL back to that.
As do I. Yes, it's radiation resistance. It's one of the reasons Dick and I used to have these discussions. Dick used to love to do the presentation on the infinitesimal dipole with the idea that you could shrink it down and the decibel loss would be very small. The effect of aperture would be identical to a full-size half-wave dipole. And then I would come on and I'd start giving him trouble and talk about how as you shrink a mechanically short antenna, even if you correct it electronically with a loading inductance, you do not bring back all the radiation resistance. And as you bring down the radiation resistance number, the insertion losses attached to the antenna system have a much more profound effect in losing energy through the insertion losses. So if you have an object that has a radiation resistance of 50 ohms and you have an insertion loss of 1 ohm, it's nothing. But if you shrink that down, you could end up with a radiation resistance of 1 or 2 ohms. And so you'd be losing half of your power just on the insertion losses. So that's kind of where the infinitesimal dipole will fail you. So I always like to discuss that. And I don't think anyone really mentioned, or at least not to my awareness, that resonant antennas have have pure resistance and have no reactance whatsoever. So I thank you, Jeff, for being the other part of this team here.
WB2VAV.
Ah, an electrical engineer. Yes, Ed.
Here's the way I look at it. Every antenna has a pattern. A dipole has a classic, you know, donut pattern. You know, a Yagi, for example, has a highly directional pattern. But as you go to a smaller and smaller antenna, if you correct for all of the things you're talking about, the antenna pattern becomes more of an isotrope. It radiates energy in all directions. So there is absolutely no focusing of the energy where you want it, and you lose ever more energy to places like straight up into outer space or down into the earth behind you more than any other pattern.
Okay, I agree with you. I think the way that I perceive it, as opposed to being a purely isotropic distribution like the old incandescent light bulb almost is that it develops these weird nodes and nulls all over the place. It becomes increasingly complicated and problematic. And yes, it somewhat inevitably takes on many of the characteristics of a near-vertical incident sky wave, which, unless you want to really communicate to your next-door neighbor, is not the antenna that most of us are looking for. Well, the gentleman, KD2BD, who answered the question in the chat room, mentioned that standing wave ratio has nothing to do with it. And then said, well, okay, maybe a little. And he's quite right. There is a very interesting YouTube that I put up on my link page for last week, so it's still available. It's just not at the top of my link page. From W2AEW, I believe. He is a technician for Tektronix. He produces very nice YouTubes, and he did one for the Nano VNA and made that point in it. It's a very interesting and useful YouTube, so I would suggest everyone sort of watch it because it'll give you a lot of insight in especially people interested in Smith charts. Because I've been trying to figure out a way of teaching Smith charts on the radio, and I still haven't figured it out because it's just way too visual. But because YouTube is visual, he's able to accomplish it. And he does a very, very good job. And he mentions that when you have a standing wave ratio of 1-to-1, on the Smith chart, you see the possible impedances for that. And they're very, very, very close to the pure resistance line. And so it's a lot easier to stay on the real resistance values if you have a visual that approaches 1-to-1. So I agree with you, KD2BD. Wish I had a radio. But anyway, thanks for playing along with me. I happen to have another puzzle. Just in case you're in a puzzling mood. This one's very short and sweet, and I don't know, it probably will be answered in about 10 seconds. Why are circuit boards, you know, printed circuit boards, why are they colored green?
Not always green.
Okay, Ed?
The really cheap single-sided ones are brown. It's the G10 glass epoxy that's historically the green.
Well, I think the green coloration is primarily the solder mask.
It's a darker green, but the boards are kind of like a mint green.
Okay, but why are the solder masks green?
Things in life I just accept without questioning.
Okay, that's an approach. Does anyone else have any good ideas of why green is what a lot of, not all solder masks are green. If you've taken apart enough equipment, you've seen circuit boards that are yellow and black. You know, black is very edgy. But overwhelmingly, the color that you're going to see in most circuit boards is going to be green. So anyone out there with any good ideas of why green?
Verdigris?
Yeah, sure.
That was my comment. Verdigris. It was a joke about copper green oxidation.
Oh. No. Okay. I just thought that you wanted to answer the question. It's surprisingly biological.
What would I know about that? AEC2PL, back to that.
Okay. Anyone else want to hazard a guess? The points will not be taken off.
Oh, Roy, just a comment.
Certainly, Ed.
I understand your point. I'm fine with it 90-95% of the time. But on some military projects, I have found boards that tend to be a rust color. And the board itself is a lighter rust color, and the solder mask is a darker rust color. So it's not 100%. But yeah, 90-95%, I'm with you, and I do not have an answer.
Okay, our gentleman in the chat room suggested to prevent mold. No, it's not to prevent mold. One of the answers, there's a couple of answers, but actually one of the answers is historically the military. The military had a standard for a time where they required to have green solder masks. So boards from the time that you found non-green, I guess, are when the military changed their regulations. But there was a time period where the military had a requirement for PC boards to have a green solder mask.
Never came across it in all my military work.
Okay, I might have been of an era that predates it. I don't know the details of the military regulations. Anyone else want to hazard a guess? Again, I'm giving a hint that it is basically an organic reason, not an electronic one. Okay, very well. Because we evolved the way that we did, green is probably the best color for us to be able to tell differences in different shades of green. So they did a whole bunch of studies to see what kind of solder masks would allow people to visually inspect circuit boards for failures. And they found that green was the best color under those circumstances. Even electronic inspection is probably a little bit better with green than the other colors. Not sufficient that they won't do other colors. Also, there are some qualities in the green type of solder masks. They use a chlorine and bromine agents that are a little less toxic than the ones that do the other colors. But it's primarily just human visual capabilities, that in the old days when visual inspections were made on circuit boards, green was found to be the best for that method. So that's why your PC boards, a lot of the time, are green, unless they want to be flashy about it. So that's my puzzles for tonight. Another gentleman in the chat room had mentioned that he took his tech exam yesterday and passed, and he's looking forward to getting a call sign and chatting with the ladies and gentlemen soon. So hopefully Papa Whiskey will get a proper call sign and join us on this technical net. I hope so. So, I gave you my two puzzles for tonight. Anyone with any other questions or comments?
Just a silly question. Was this the Limehawk session at Levitt Town Hall yesterday morning?
I do not know. I will ask him. A pop or whiskey. Where did you pass your exam? Yes, that was him.
AC2PL coming.
Yes, Jeff.
I just wanted to make mention that the color of the boards, although I did not get the answer correct, and that's very interesting, the answer that you preferred, is well known for certain devices like the IFR 1200S. If you get a device in a particular serial number range and it has the blue boards, it's well known that those boards delaminate easily, so desoldering devices from the boards to fix those machines is very precarious. You could easily pull the copper off the board. My machine happens to be a later vintage, and it's I think the boards are all green in there or a different color, so it's easy to spot, but they are easily differentiated based on that, and it's something to just make mention of, because they do run in a particular vein for a particular device, USL AC2PL.
Okay, that's interesting to know. There are some slight different qualities in the materials with different colors. I think that the greens require a lot less thickness in order to operate well. whereas the other colors have a distribution that you have to make them a little bit thicker to work as well as green. So it could be that they got the thickness off wrong in their run of blue solder pad things. So that's interesting. Well, I mean, there's so many ways to foul up electronics, unfortunately. I think the overwhelming majority are buying cheap capacitors, electrolytic capacitors, that go bad about a week and a half after you sell the darn things.
By the way, talking about boards, you know, the sixth layer or even more boards are fairly common when you get into serious stuff.